Gamal Nasser, the premier of Egypt, who famously said, "You Jews left black and came back white.
We have a long fight ahead of us.
Here I am.
Here I am.
Here I am.
And here I am.
Here I am.
And here I am.
And here I am. We shall never die."
My guest today is a pastor, author of the book Zionism and the Black Church, and founder and CEO of the Institute for Black Solidarity with Israel. I am really excited to say, here I am with Dumisani Washington.
How are you doing, Shai? Great to be with you today.
Thank you so much for making the trip, yeah, for being here. I'm looking forward to learning about what you've been doing and how you got here, yeah, honestly. But before we start, I'm going to start with a very straightforward question, but also very general. Yeah. Dumisani, what are you fighting for?
What am I fighting for? It's a good question. I never heard a phrase like that. Truth and peace. It sounds very boilerplate, but, you know, justice, real. For me, in this fight in particular, legacy is on the line, right? When it comes to, and I know we'll unpack it, I'm sure, when it comes to issues like Israel's peace and security, anti-Semitism, how those things are wedge issues used within our society, but particularly and uniquely how the black community has been exploited in that fight, it's a legacy issue for me, among other things.
What do you mean when you say legacy? Legacy is something that's been passed down.
Yeah,
absolutely. Who passed it down to you?
So for me, Shai, again, in this particular fight, when it comes to how Israel is demonized in the West, right, very, very different concept than on the actual, here's the kinetic war, here's Israel surrounded by enemies trying to make peace and from the time of 1948 till now. And then Israel's enemies see that we're not going to be able to remove these Israelis. They're not going anywhere. They're fighting, then they, against all odds, keep winning these battles. Once the propaganda war got started, it was focused not in the Middle East, obviously, it's focused on the West, the United Nations and different organizations. And the rhetoric around those things was almost racial, almost always racial. Israel's an apartheid state. Zionism is racism, all of these things, right? Which, and as an affront to the people who actually went through that. Now, is it not true, right? Now, is it not an apartheid state, right? But apartheid was a real thing that black South Africans experienced. Racism, a real thing, which was part of the civil rights movement, black and Jewish people working together. And so it was an intentional ploy on the part of Israel's enemies to use that rhetoric to demonize Israel. There's many starting points, but what I often point to was the foundation of the PLO, which is it sometimes sounds controversial, but all these receipts are here, a KGB-created organization. Yasser Arafat becomes the chairman in 1969, and the goal and the methods are very, very clear. Reach out to the black community, take pictures, get photo ops, and sell his genocidal aims as a civil rights movement. It was far-fetched in the 60s, but you and I are now living proof on our college campuses and beyond. It worked. It was a diabolical plan that worked. Why? Because young people who don't even can't find Gaza on a map, don't know anything about the conflict, they see it as a Israel white settler colonial occupying power. Palestinians are brown people who are being oppressed, just like what happened during the civil rights movement. None of that is true, but that was the narrative that was sold. That's what I mean by legacy.
That is so fascinating. You know, we're 2 minutes into this, and I'm already... Because one thing I haven't even considered is I've always considered the lie aspects of all this propaganda. The genocide, apartheid, ethnic cleansing, all that. I never considered the flip side of the coin, which is... It's an affront to people that actually go through these things.
Absolutely.
You know, there are real genocides happening right now in the world.
Yes, sir.
It's an affront to them to say that. And and I've never thought about what it feels like to be a non-Jewish black American and saying, why are you calling them racist? Like, we're dealing with an actual thing here.
What is that exploitative process, like you said, it has many different victims, right? obviously, the first and foremost, let's demonize Israel, let's demonize Jews. Again, work like a charm, because here you have, even regardless to what one feels about the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, what does that have to do with attacking Jews, Jewish students on Harvard's or Yale's or UCLA's campuses? Two have nothing to do with each other, but that was the diabolical plot. Somehow connect Jews with whatever you feel is going on in Israel, and then boom, they become open season, right? That was the first casualty.
But can I push back for a second?
Sure.
Because in around 2020, I don't remember what magazine it was, but there was an article with Yahya Sinwar, the head of Hamas, who's now eliminated, but who masterminded October 7 massacre, basically talking about the murder of George Floyd. And at that point, you know, a broken clock is right, you know, some of the time. And he was right. Like, there was a big problem there. I'd say if I were, you know, a non-Jewish black American reading this, they're like, look, this guy's speaking up for us.
Right, exactly.
Is it diabolical or does he really care?
Well, it's amazing. So that analogy has a direct correlation to the Yasser Arafat 16. This was always the plan. What Yasser Arafat did in reaching out to the black leaders of the community, it was usually the younger, more, what Dr. King called the more militant, right? And what he meant by that was that Dr. King was asked about this very phenomenon, right? Which was younger black leaders siding with Arabs against Israel. This was something that I never heard. They were hearing, Jewish leaders were hearing this type of anti-Semitic speech coming from younger black people that they never heard before. They knew what anti-Semitism was, obviously, but they never heard it coming out of the black community. So Rabbi Heschel and the other rabbis asked Dr. King, what is this? What's going on? For people who want to know, it's part of the transcript from Dr. King's appearance with the Rabbinical Assembly in 1968. So late 1960s, these things are exploding, right? And Dr. King is explaining to them that there's a younger, more militant group that sees more of a binary. In other words, if something is white, it's bad. If something is colored, it's good, right? And so the Israelis have been portrayed as white Europeans, therefore bad. Again, this is the late 1960s, right?
Wow.
And then, of course, Arabs are portrayed as people of color. Now, you and I both know there's all kinds of hues in the Middle East, right? You have darker-skinned Israelis, darker, lighter-skinned Arabs. I mean, it's not really a color thing. However, Westerners don't know that. This was true 50-plus years ago. It continues to be true today. This was the theme that the PLO began to play on. Let's make it a color race issue, right? Doesn't matter if there's Jews who come from Egypt and Libya and Yemen, and as well as Hungary and Poland. None of that matters. We know that most Westerners do not know this. So we portray this as a black against white thing. These Israelis are like white racist cops who are beating up on these brown Arabs. So when Yahya Sinwar said that in 2020, it was an old playbook. As diabolical as it was, he didn't make it up. This has been going on for a very, very long time. But it worked like a charm for people who weren't aware of what was going on the ground. So Dr. King spoke to it, and he even said to them then, he said, it's a smaller thing now, it may grow. So it was very, very, people dismissed it most of the time. They were like, oh, no, this is, they saw Israel still as the underdog, right? This is shortly after the 67 war. They saw Israel as fighting for their lives, and Israel still had a great deal of goodwill. Black, white, it didn't make any difference in the West. But over a period of time, of then portraying this as a white coming against people of color, that's what has happened over a period of time.
You know, and you used a word that's, it's a very strong word. You said, you know, exploited.
Yes, sir.
You personally feel exploited?
Absolutely. So it's funny, the first time I used that word, actually, I was, so years ago, I among the things that I've done over the last over a decade, I was on staff with Christians United for Israel as the diversity outreach coordinator. And one of the things I would do, I would take groups of pastors, different ethnicities, but oftentimes African-American pastors to Israel. And so I'm aware of this history already. I wrote about it in my book and everything. And so one of our speakers in Jerusalem was Khaled Abu Tuame. He's an Arab-Israeli journalist. They're very, very well-known. And he did give a whole lecture about the conflict and some of the things that many people aren't aware of in terms of if you're from the West. And so when he was done, I asked him, I said, Khaled, could you please talk to these pastors for a moment? Because as a young Arab journalist, he worked as part of Yasser Arafat's press corps back in the day. That's how he got his start. when he began to report on things that they didn't want him to report on, like what the Palestinians were doing to their own people, they kind of shunned him. That's kind of how his career moved from there. So I asked him to please tell these black pastors what that procedure was. You were here. And the first thing out of his word, out of his mouth was exploitation.
So he admitted.
He used that word. He said that. I said, that's what Yasser Arafat's goal was. Exploit people based on the fact that they don't know this. And again, when I say I tell this to black pastors all the time, don't know doesn't mean you and I may not have knowledge of something. That doesn't make us stupid. It doesn't mean we may not know. We may not know about this thing, right? So if I'm not aware, then I can be exploited based on what I don't know. I'd have to at least get the rest of the information. So if someone comes to me and says all kinds of horrible things, David, blah, 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 Shy, da, da, da. I'm going, okay, if I don't know, right? So I'm going, okay, I don't. But if I talk to Shy and I get the rest of the story, I go, oh, okay, they weren't really telling me the truth. So then Yasser Arafat and the PLO becomes the mouthpiece for what's going on in the field. And I'm doing it in the, I'm couching it in the terms of justice. We were just living our lives. Then came the Nakba and these Jews who are not even real Jews. They came from Europe and they stole our land and the same tradition of the Native Americans. And I'm listening to all this. It's resonating because I know some of the story from the other things you're pulling from, right? But I don't know well beyond what actually happened in terms of the reestablishing of the state of Israel, who the Jewish people are, the goodwill. We're not talking about the diaspora of the Jewish people. We're not talking about the airlifting that's coming from Yemen. None, just leave those things out. It was Gamal Nasser, the premier of Egypt, who famously said, you Jews left black and came back white. He said that for the press. He knew that there's a huge Jewish population in Egypt right there as he was speaking, right? But he knew Westerners didn't know that. So he says, so if I'm a Westerner and I don't know anything other than about the Jewish population, other than who I see maybe in New York or in LA, I don't know what a Mizrahi Jew is. I don't know. I don't know this from that. The Jewish friends know that. They know that there's a huge array. But if I don't know that, if a Jew to me is Jerry Seinfeld or Steven Spielberg, period, right? Right. Then somebody says to me, Jews are white. So I'm going, okay, well, based on what you're saying and I don't know anything else, sure, Jews are white. And especially if I've been sold that somehow white is bad, white is evil, which is what Dr. King was dealing with. You put all these things together, the exploitation becomes, I'm going to give you a narrative about Israel that is completely bogus, but it's going to play on what you don't know. It's going to play on traditional racism and discrimination. And therefore, that's what you're going to think. That's why you get an 18-year-old on a campus who's never been there. He'll tell you all kinds of things about Israel that aren't true, but it's what he's been told by TikTok on his campuses. That's the exploitation that's happened. So personally, yeah, because again, it goes back to, yeah, but no, people have experienced those things. That's not what Israel's doing. Yeah.
What kind of reactions do you get? Because you do a lot of work. We'll get to that.
Yes, sir.
Speaking with many young black Americans.
Yes, sir. Yes, sir.
And you tell them, look, you're being exploited. What's the reaction that people give you?
It's a wider range, but the most part is listening. So when it's the younger groups that I'm talking to, they're listening because they either haven't heard it before or it hasn't really been explained to them before. That's part of the struggle that we're dealing with right now. And so they have a lot of questions. And they'll sometimes, like me when I was younger, there'll be the frustration. The anger, like, okay, I didn't know this. I didn't know these things, right? I remember one time I was talking to someone and they were saying, I was saying with the Palestinians are being oppressed. I said, do you know that Hamas is the third wealthiest terrorist organization in the world, according to Forbes magazine? They just looked at me. I said, no, they have crap tons of money. I said, now the people are poor, but the people who are exploiting them. So they said to me first thing, I didn't know any of that. I said, yeah, you might want to research a little bit more because some of what you're being told are by very wealthy, powerful people who are exploiting other people. And they connect that. They go, oh, I know what that is. I know what it is to have a poor neighborhood and have people on the top who are exploiting the people down there. They make those kind of connections. Mm. The older pastors, the older leaders, they are often very, very grateful. That's the overwhelming thing. We'll do a seminar. We'll do a talk. We'll explain what's going on. Everything from Israel's righteous fight to exist, right? We'll talk about things like how the same people who are accusing Israel of doing these horrible things are aware of the slave trade that's throughout western parts of Africa and won't say anything about those things. Those pastors will, and other black leaders will say, thank you. I didn't realize that. Thank you so much, Pastor Musain, for coming and sharing this with us, because they'll often feel, they may not use the word exploitation, but they will tell you that they'll get pressure as a black leader to stand on the side of justice, which already has been defined as Palestinian. Mm. That somehow if they're black and they defend Israel, that they're not being true to their justice ethos, right? They will thank us. They'll say, okay, I didn't realize any of these things.
To be fair, yes. Everyone should be standing on the side of justice. The problem is when you don't identify what is just and what is unjust.
This is, Shai, when you asked me in terms of legacy, that's part of the thing that I've talked to this with older, younger black leaders in different communities and everything. Rightly or wrongly, I talk about this in my book as well. There's an expectation that, particularly for a black person of age, that there you represent, again, rightly or wrongly, a certain amount of justice, the whole slavery to freedom, Jim Crow, that you come from a legacy of people who've gone through these things, right? Again, I say rightly or wrongly because, again, just because someone may be from that ethnic group, they may not have a purview of some of those things, but that's often what's expected. So because that's the case, and I tell pastors often this thing becomes our quote-unquote cross to bear. In other words, there's the positive and negative with that. The positive would be that, yes, then I'm supposed to be a voice, then that means my voice has weight. That means that what I say matters, so that I should inform myself. The negative is that I can get pigeonholed. And like you said, if justice is defined by quote-unquote Palestinian liberation, and those words sound fine by themselves, right? Because who's not for liberation, right? If you're just, who's against just Palestinians just for the purpose of being against them? Nobody wants to be on that side of history. But if you recognize, that's why they call it the Palestine Liberation Organization. That was the manipulation. Because instead of saying, we want to kill the Jews from the river to the sea, they said, we want to liberate Palestine, right? Right. That's how the manipulation happened. And so often black leaders will be expected to stand on the right side of history. So how are you as a black leader going to stand against liberation, right? How are you going to stand against justice? And that's how it gets manipulated. That's how it gets so twisted and everything.
And again, I want to play devil's advocate, not because I believe in it, but because I want to give people a fair chance, let's say. A lot of, you talk with a non-Jewish young black kid and they'll say, look, Dumisani, I get what you're saying, but no one's exploiting me. Like, it's coming from inside the house. Ta-Nehisi Coates, yes, various chapters of Black Lives Matter, more extreme. You got like Kyrie Irving, Kanye West, Dave Chappelle, like luminaries in our community, meaning the Black American community. Mm-hmm. We're not being exploited. We're, Ta-Nehisi Coates is one of the most celebrated black writers or writers in general of the past 20 years.
Absolutely. And to those types of conversations, what we've done, like any other group, we said that no group is a monolith. There's always going to be different attitudes and different ideas within that ethnic group or even within that religious group. And so we'll point to that first and foremost and say, yes, within that great tradition, there have always been different black voices who maybe didn't agree on a certain thing. You have Booker T. Washington and W.B. Du Bois. They were contemporaries, but they came to the whole black liberation issue from two totally different perspectives, right? So we said that's always something that we respect. So when we're talking about those luminaries that you discuss, who are very well known, often very wealthy, very, very celebrated, we say with respect, they can still be dead wrong. The fact that you are who you are as a comedian, as an entertainer, and an entrepreneur, but you have ideas that are rooted in things that are completely not true. So you bring up Ta-Nehisi Coates as an example. We wrote in our Substack a couple of articles about this in particular. I'll give you an example. I'm just using him as an example. We could use many of them. Ta-Nehisi Coates, several months ago, came out with his latest book. It wasn't about Israel, but there's three parts of it. The last part was about Israel. Called it an apartheid state, what Israel's doing. He may have used the word genocide, the same tropes, right? And our organization took him to task because the things are not true. He traveled to Israel with one of the groups. I can't remember the name, what it was. And he, said he did the exploration. He came back and wrote all these damning things about Israel. And so we took him to task both on the fact that it wasn't true, what he was saying, right? It's not an apartheid state. Whatever you think that it is, there are black South Africans who don't agree with the fact that it's an apartheid state. So your words have power. You're a very well-known person. But we also talked about the fact of the hypocrisy. We called out the hypocrisy because right around that time, what had resurfaced was a video from 1994, 95, Howard University, which is where he went to school. In March of 1995, I believe I have my date correct, there was a conference at Howard University that dealt with the trans-Saharan slave trade, which is still active for people who don't know. It started in the 7th century. So there's African slaves in Nigeria or in Sudan, Mauritania, Algeria. This is still, these are the remnants of the slave trade that started after Muhammad's death. This has been going on for millennia, obviously. Ta-Nehisi Coates was a young undergraduate, was at that conference. We know because the video is there. And he asked a question of the panel. The panel consisted of Africans from Mauritania, from Sudan, as well as my dear friend, Jewish friend, Charles Jacobs, who's actually organized the whole event, right? And in that exchange, Shai, he asked the panel, what should we do about people like Louis Farrakhan who are denying what you say is true? This was, he was what, 21 years old, right? Now, when he asked that question, more context, it was several months after the Million Man March, which was in D.C.,
yeah,
by Louis Farrakhan, who was well aware of the slave trade, but now he was shilling for people like Omar Bashir, the president of Sudan, telling people that there was no slave trade. He used his huge voice to say the opposite. Now, you don't get a bigger voice, especially in the 90s, in terms of the Black community, than Louis Farrakhan. And you have a Ta-Nehisi Coates asking questions as a young student. And one of the things we pointed out is that Ta-Nehisi Coates, you've known about the slave trade of Africans for now 30 years. Silence. But Israel's an apartheid state. These are the types of hypocrisies that we point out. We're saying even within the Black community, if we're not going to speak truth to power within our own community, what are we doing? If speak truth to power is only to white people and white racists, but it's not going to be a reckoning in my own community, then what are we doing, right? Mm-hmm. That is what we call the Black prophetic voice, that we're going to hold each other accountable as well. So if you're going to go out in the marketplace and ignore what you've known for 30 years, the slave trade of Africans right now, but then you want to use your huge voice to come against Israel, the only free democracy in the Middle East where Africans are free and Arabs are free and Christians and Muslims. And no, we're going to take you to task and we're not going to hold back by doing that. So this is as an example. Yes, we push back on those things, not so much to attack them as persons, right, to come against them. We're not talking about your mom. We're talking about, no. But we are going to deal with the fact that you as a huge voice, you're going to put that out there with no responsibility, right? Just you sound like electronic intifada. Right. You sound like just this Al Jazeera talking points and it's not true. But here's what you're not speaking about. And you've known to be true for more than 30 years.
But that gets to, the second problem. The first problem is people just don't know. And you said, like, look, yes, you can't blame someone for not having the fact. You can blame them for not looking for the facts, but not for not having the facts, for being miseducated. Mm-hmm. But, and at the same time, Ta-Nehisi Coates does not fall. He's a brilliant guy, you know, regardless of what you think of the guy and his writing.
Yes,
he's got brains.
Absolutely.
So it's not a lack of education there. What's going on in...
Now you've stepped into the more nefarious part of it. Because if I do know the truth, I can lie by omission or commission. I can lie by not telling you what I know to be true. I can lie by just straight up saying what I know is not true. Mm. And this is, again, for us, there is a sense of duty and honor when it comes to, we use those words, justice and that type of, everybody's for that. But, and everybody can be for something that doesn't cost anything. But no one needs to tell you it costs something to stand up and say, okay, wait. This is wrong, right? You find out who your friends are, all that kind of stuff, right? You really, it's an isolating thing. I always call it the prophetic tradition, like a Jeremiah or whatever, you know, you start speaking stuff that nobody wants to hear, even within your own camp, you're going to get ostracized, right? Right. But that's what the price of it, right? Anybody slapping you on the back when everybody's all cool and agreeing on whatever the stuff is, right? But when somebody has to say, okay, wait a minute, something's wrong here. This is not good. That person generally will get the attacks. They'll get the slings, they'll get the arrows and stuff. So in that example of a Ta-Nehisi Coates, and we can use others, here's a situation where, again, you know something to be true, but you refuse to speak out. That's a lie by omission, right? I use that example from Howard University in the 1990s. You're one of the most celebrated authors in history, not just Black authors, right? Yeah. They have comic books, op-eds, everything, right? So you have a huge platform, right, in a Christian tradition There's a gospel passage that said, "To whom much is given, much is required." It's the church version of, you know,
yeah, with great power.
Yes,
I like that. Yeah, before Spider-Man,
right? It's a biblical thing, right? So, and it's true. And if we're going to put this in the context in terms of the Black community, because this is, it's multi-ethnic, it's a universal thing, but I'm using it now in terms of the Black community. That means for me, I have an obligation based on who came before me to speak truth to power, to recognize what justice actually is. If Dr. King fought against anti-Semitism, not only because it was wrong, like he said, but because once that gets happening, what's going to happen to Black people? Once we get to discriminate and come against people based on their ethnicity or religion, he said, what do you think is going to happen in a society in which we're already fighting for our rights, right? He was saying that the Negro, I'm saying he's in his text, the Negro should be the first one fighting against anti-Semitism. He said, because we know what it is to be discriminated against based on who we are. He said, he's talking again to the younger generation.
By the way, that's very brilliant observation. Yes. Because the mindset, yes, Rabbi Heschel's mindset, and many people, and unfortunately it's changing, but it, yes, should still be our mindset. But, yes, for Jews, you know, we, yes, should be fighting racism, not just because it's bad. Obviously, yes, that's the number one thing.
Yes.
But because we know what happens when you start targeting a group based, yes, on a demographic that they have no control over.
Yes. Yeah. At some point, it's coming for you. And they said this in the 60s, and it's true today, right? So when it comes to fighting this battle as a Black leader, right? Again, no people are a monolith. So we never assume to speak for the quote-unquote Black community. We are voices within the Black community, right? And so what we're making sure that we're doing is making sure our voices are heard and making sure we're empowering others by educating them, right? So again, the lie by omission to us is just as egregious as a lie by commission, because once you have a platform and once people are looking to you as a moral authority, as some sort of voice that they listen to, and you refuse to do something, this is why I took it to heart, because I go back to the Africa part of it. Long before I was doing any type of Israel work and fighting against anti-Semitism, Shai, I was, as a pastor, as a young pastor, I was aware of things like religious persecution back from the 80s, right? From the 80s, where I was first introduced to Christians being killed for their faith in the 1980s while I was in college, right? A friend of mine went to Romania, which had just fallen because of Nicolae Ceausescu, had just, you know, been deposed. He was killed. He had gone there. They took Bibles to people, different churches that had been scattered. And he came back. He told me, Dumisani, I never experienced this before. So I grew up in church as a young kid, but I had never heard of that before. I lived in my American bubble, right? Church was, you go to church and you do your choir thing, your church thing. But there were Christians outside of these borders, Christians in China, Christians in Russia, Christians. I never heard of those things before. So it kind of blew me away. So by the 90s, when I'm a young pastor now, this is something I'm kind of focused on. I'm watching these things. I'm following them. The internet's not really a real thing. So it exists, but not great. So I can get some information from the New York Times and everything I'm following. I'm saying all this for a reason. I start to adopt a couple of nations. My focus was Africa. So the Darfur region, before it became a thing, yeah, I'm following all these things, right? Rwanda, although it wasn't much of a religious and more tribal, but still, I'm watching these things, particularly where the church is concerned. So it was interesting to me that the time that I was delving into this is when Ta-Nehisi Coates was learning about it. I didn't know who he was. He was some undergraduate, right? Yeah. And I said, you've known about this as long as I have. But I don't have your platform. For 30 years after you've known about this and you've blown up, you're a household name. Do you know what you could have done to help slaves in Nigeria, or slaves in Sudan or Mauritania, by just saying something, by just bringing awareness to it? No, not one time. And I even challenged him in an article. I said, I'm looking for it. I said, you know, with all due respect, maybe you have and I've missed it. Maybe you spoke at a lecture. Maybe you probably, I did my Google search as much as I could, Shai. Find something where Ta-Nehisi Coates has actually ever addressed this issue. Couldn't find it at all. So when his book came out, he bashes Israel. Yeah. So he got double barrels at that point. This is not true, yeah, but here it is true, and you've never spoken about it at all.
You know, and the interesting thing is, and I say this, we recently had Simon Deng here, who's a Black Christian.
I'll see South him tonight. Sudanese, in a minute. Yes, sir.
Who's a former slave, yes, in South Sudan,
yes, sir,
as a child.
Yes, sir.
And he, you know, when you talk with him, you're like, it's so shocking and it's so powerful. But you realize one important thing.
Yes, sir.
his experience of slavery is not the prototypical perception of slavery in the United States.
Yes,
the experience of racism is very specific. Yes, it's non-black on black racism. So in Ta-Nehisi Coates, you know, his response to what you're saying is like, that's not the issue. That's not a big deal. I'm not worried about slavery. I'm worried about when non-blacks, attack blacks.
You know, it's amazing.
Which, by the way, is a huge problem. I'm not saying it's not. But this is my angle.
What's amazing is a video that I cited in 1995 when he was at Howard University. He was responding to the panel. And the panel, he even says in his question, these are Africans who are wanting to bring the awareness of what's going on with them to Black Americans, the most powerful Africans in the diaspora. So they were bringing this issue here, contacted Louis Farrakhan, asked him if they could speak about it at the march. He told them. He didn't even respond to them. And then he goes on a tour, basically calls them liars. So the reason I bring that up is Ta-Nehisi Coates asked the question in that context, based on the fact that you are asking Black Americans to help you, what should we do about people like Louis Farrakhan who are calling you guys liars, right? So why am I saying all that? He recognized that the reason why they came all the way to Washington, D.C. at Howard University as these Africans was because they were coming to whom they feel. I have an African pastor friend down in, he's Nigerian, but lives in South Africa, Shy, and he blew me away. He said to me, Dumisani, African Americans are the Joseph to the Africans' brothers in Egypt when they came looking for food. I went, whoa. He said, here we are sold into slavery, but we've risen to the highest heights in Western civilization. Right? Doesn't mean racism doesn't exist. It just means, like I said, I did my friend David here, superheroes. We defied all the odds, just like our Jewish brothers and sisters, became presidents, became heads of state, became all kinds of different things here, slaves, chattel slavery. But in Africa, there's these things that are still going on. Not all of Africa, obviously Africa's huge, right? But slavery is still an issue. Hundreds of thousands, probably millions in places that I've already named. So they came with that mindset. I'll tell you a quick story. Pastors, we have stories. Me and rabbis and pastors, we always have stories.
I love it.
To get older.
Hey, I'm not a rabbi and not a pastor, but I...
Yes, sir, I have these stories. So years ago, 2016, I believe it was, when I was part of Christians United for Israel, I did my one and only college tour to Israel, right? It was all Black students, all Black college students. My friend David Walker was over the college chapter of it, of CUFI. I wasn't, but he said, I want you to come with me to this group. They're from HBCUs. They're Black students from all over the country, right? It's an amazing, amazing trip. And so David asked me to help him kind of plan the trip, you know, different speakers. And I said, sure, no problem. We had an amazing time. And one of the speakers, his name is Omar. Omar is a Sudanese refugee who fled Sudan in the early 2000s, one of those many ways that came that wound up in Israel. Was doing really well, owned a money exchange business and everything, went to college and everything. Many people don't know about those communities that are in Israel, right? So I asked him to come and speak. David, he spoke to the, I mean, Shy, I'm sorry, to my friend David. Shy, he spoke to the group and maybe about 20, 30 minutes and everything. He's not as loud as me. He's very, very nice voice and soft and everything. He told them about what happened, how he was separated from his family, how he fled, the millions that were killed or displaced, all the horrors that they heard about maybe in the news, but here's a real life person who experienced all of those things. And his life in Israel and everything, and running businesses, I think he was married at the time, whatever. So when he was done speaking, we took questions, right? So I'm monitoring everything because, I planned it, so I'll make sure everything's going right. So they start asking questions.
You're a good professor, even though you're a pastor.
Watching the whole thing, David, and the people, the young, I was so proud of those young people. They're so amazing. They raise their hand. Thank you so much for coming, Mr. I ask you, who's responsible or what should be done? Each of their questions was along the lines of, who do we need to contact to fix this? Because you just describe horrors that I have never heard before, right? You still don't know where your family is because when you left, you guys scattered. You have a brother, but you haven't contacted him in a while. So we're hearing all these things in the millions, not just a couple of people, millions of people, right? I'm trying to wrap my brain around what you're saying. And after about the third or fourth question, I could see the disconnect in the room because at first I wasn't sure what was going on. Because they would ask him a question and he had a certain amount of bewilderment in his face and he would answer it very, very politely. And then finally he said, I don't think you know who you are. He's telling this to the students. You have the power to help free my country. And they didn't know what he meant. And that's when I got up as a referee at that point. Not that they're arguing. I said to them, to you all, you are the most powerful Africans on the planet. You are Black Americans who they know were taken as slaves. You are the descendants of those people. And you go to Howard and you go to Spelman. You go to all these other Berkeley schools from all over the country. You represent the cream of the crop of the Black American community. You are the dream that your ancestors fought for. So you have power. You can walk into governor's offices, White House, Congress. You have access as American citizens. So for him, that was a moment for me as well, because I wasn't even thinking on those lines until he said that. He's like, oh, no, he's thinking I'm talking to American delegates, Black Americans, who will now take my story back to America and help me do this. So he's literally saying, you're going to help me fix this. They're asking him different questions, trying to wrap their brains about what was going on. And David, he had invested in them a power that they had, but they didn't understand that they had.
Yeah.
That makes sense?
It's a little bit like trying to get people, Jewish people around the world, outside of Israel, to remember you are the strongest Jews in history. You know, other than Jews in Israel, like Jewish Americans, they have the, you know, people say that libelous, you know, conspiracy theories. We don't control the media or finance, but we are extremely influential in many different things.
Yes, sir. Yes, sir.
Don't wait for someone else to do something. You do it.
Yes, sir. Yes, sir. Absolutely.
But Dumisani, you are clearly passionate about this.
Yes, sir.
It's exuding passion. I want to get to how you got to this, which is, look, unfortunately, a lot of different groups and powers are exploiting the Black American community.
Mm-hmm.
How do you get excited about this one specific issue of Israel, Jews?
Well, in fairness, this is one of many issues for which I'm passionate, where this comes to the education is another one, right? Business finance, in other words, knowing our legacy and what we've come through and how there have been forces that have tried to tear that apart. So the Israel part becomes another leg of that, meaning because I am aware of our history in that, whether we call it spiritual Zionism, like the Negro spirituals, all these things that are from our long past here in the States, which helped define us as a people and gave us the impetus to move forward. There's a reason why we would identify with the whole Moses and the children of Israel come out of slavery. We call Harriet Tubman the Black Moses. All these different songs that were set in the Old Testament, Go Down Moses, Joshua, the Battle of Jericho, all these songs about deliverance and redemption, they were embedded within the Black church experience, right? There's a reason. That wasn't just happenstance. We gravitated to those things for many, many different reasons. And they became strength for us over the centuries to endure centuries of slavery, to endure the Jim Crow segregation and the lynchings and the KKK, all those things, to not just survive, but to actually thrive in doing those things. So Israel becomes part of that as well, because again, in the 60s, when Israel's being defined in all these racist terms and anti-Semitism is being used as a wedge issue to come at our community, these things are very, very important to me because I recognize that not only are they lies, not only are they exploitative lies, but they are lies that tear at the fabric of actually who we are. When someone stands up and says Jesus was a Palestinian, which is part of the whole propaganda, right? For the Black church person from back in the day, we know that's hogwash, right? But you're actually trying to come against a biblical narrative that was for us very powerful. Zion wasn't a political thing for us. We didn't recognize what the whole political Zionism, but it was a spiritual thing. We would sing songs like We're Marching to Zion. We would sing songs about getting up in the New Jerusalem. These are things that were very much embedded in our culture. So when we would see these hateful things coming against Israel and against Jews, some of that was actually also coming against what was a legacy spiritually as well, which is why you would get some of the whacked out pastors stand up talking about Jesus as a Palestinian, and the real issue is now the Romans are the Jews of today. And then no, you're completely taking biblical narrative, you're twisting it around, and you're in that way coming against a real ethos, right, that actually helps sustain us. So the passion was part of that, David, that I am the youngest of seven children. Both my parents have passed away. Both my parents were very opinionated, but my dad was just more quiet. My mom was the big mouth, so I got that from my mom. She was the type of person, she would tell you her opinion whether you asked her or not. And she's very Israeli in the sense that...
Yeah, I was going to ask her, is your mom Jewish? But yeah.
You would never wonder, one thing about Lillian Washington, who I love, they love her or hated her, you didn't have to ask somebody what she meant by. She didn't do innuendo, but she would just tell you, boom, this is how it is, right? So I got both of them in me, very opinionated, but especially her mouth. So when I became aware... I came that whole spiritual Zionist, how I grew up. I'm a musician and everything. And those songs, not only did we sing them, I would play them and perform them and teach them and everything. Right up to like Lift Every Voice and Sing, which is a very, very Zionist song. Most people don't know it. It's a very, very Zionist song. The NBA and the NFL do their thing with it and everything like that. But it's a very, very Zionist song. So for me, David, once I became aware of what the propaganda war was and how my people's struggle was central in that propaganda, oh, yeah, it pissed me off. Mm. I was like, really? And also, again, knowing about stuff like, okay, another little quick story. Eldridge Cleaver was the Minister of Information for the Black Panthers back in the 1960s in Oakland, California. Fell-out Marxist, anti-American destroyer. I mean, his goal was to literally, he said himself, he wanted to overthrow the American government and cut Nixon, President Nixon's head off. He wanted to decapitate the president. This dude, he was like, talking about a revolutionary. He was like, he wasn't just about talking about it, he was about being about it, right? He bought and sold, he bought the whole lie about Israel as an imperialist state, that type of thing, right? It was sold to him. He met Yasser Arafat in Algeria. It was like this convention of all these revolutionary groups. You know what began to gnaw at Eldridge Cleaver when he's in Algeria? He saw black slaves for the first time in his life. And he's like, hold up. Remember, this guy is a fight for justice. Regardless of what you thought about his mentality, he was about that life. Like, boom, we're going to free people from oppression. So when he saw people who looked like him, because they looked like him, were slaves, so he asked his Arab friends, he goes, what's that? And he's dismissed, oh, yeah, that's kind of what it is. He's like going, no, that's not a thing, right? So when he saw that and he saw other forms of oppression of some of these other communists and Islamist states that he went to, he came back to the United States, right? He's like going, whoa, I know what racism is, but wow, this is a completely different level. And he began to dig deeper and found out that the lies that he's being told, including about Israel and the Jewish people, he said, you know, not only is that not true, they have been some of the staunchest allies we've had for generations. He became a Zionist. He came back, fought on behalf of Israel, fought against anti-Semitism. The Angela Davises and them, they all dismissed him. But his thing was like going, look, I've been there. I went to the people that they said were our friends, and I saw a lot of bloodshed and hurt, and I saw slaves. They take people who look like us, and they are slaves. So he came back. He said, no, this is not the case. So for me, what I'm hearing some people calling Israel, going, now is that not true? Do you know what's going on right over there in Syria and Iraq? Do you know what's happening right there in Nigeria? Do you know Boko Haram, the Bring Back Our Girls? Those girls are still gone. They're sending them back now as suicide bombers now to their own old villages and everything. So Hamas is Boko Haram, is Hezbollah, is Islamic Jihad, is Al-Qaeda. I said, oh, okay. So when it got crystallized like that for me, oh, yeah, I got really pissed off. I was like, oh, okay. So the fight is the fight against real oppression, right? Real imperialism against people who want to be free. So yeah, like an Eldridge Cleaver, not that I was ever, you know, became a communist revolutionary or anything like that, but I get it. So when I read about his story, I felt the visceralness of it. I'm going, yeah, I totally get that. Like going, not only you've been lied to, like Malcolm X hoodwinked, bamboozled, right? Now you've been lied to, but they exploited your people. They used you. I would tell young black students, I said, they're laughing at you and lying to you. They're telling you, say, free, free Palestine, wave this flag. They know you don't really know what's going on. While there were black slaves in Gaza as well, that whole neighborhood that's there are descendants from people who are slaves from the transatlantic slave trade who came there to that area. So they have an old town in Gaza that's called Abid.
Which Abid in Arabic is slave.
Yes. So they're like going, so they know that you don't know this. While they call Israel racist, they still call you Abid. Now, again, this is not some sort of anti-Muslim, anti-Arab. No, no, no. Because there are Arab Muslims who work with us, what's called the African Jewish Alliance, another organization we're part of, who risk their lives. Arab and African Muslims who risk their lives to actually speak out about the same horrors that I'm talking about right now. Like I said to you, and so now when they speak out, then they get ostracized, right? Because they are people who are committed to justice. See, justice isn't a Jewish thing. It's not a Christian thing. It's not a Muslim thing. Hebrew, tzedek is a Hebrew word, but I'm saying the concept of it, right, becomes universal, becomes something that some either men or women are willing to stand up for. Either you're willing to do that or you're not. What we find is that the numbers get smaller and smaller when that situation gets more and more difficult, when it gets more and more difficult to speak out. So the passion for me, again, it's from my family, right? My mom was like this. So they weren't Zionists in the sense that they weren't involved in these types of things like I was. And later on, I applied these same principles to what's going on here now. So the passion of it is, yes, that while we are demonizing the freest nation in the region, there are still slaves all over the place. The Yazidi women who were brought as slaves through the tunnels to the Al-Qaeda and Hamas operatives in Gaza that we found out about after October the 7th. What the hell? What about them? Well, we just know about Syria just now, just the other day, right? Nothing. Thousands of people, nothing. But Israel, but free, free Palestine. This is the price that's being paid. I'll say this as a pastor spiritually. The spiritual price is now here we are coming against Israel while the United Nations spends all of its time passing these resolutions against Israel. Where's the resolution about what's going on in Syria or Nigeria or Mauritania?
In the DNC in Congo.
Yes.
Just last week.
Yes.
There were basically a massacre of Black Christians.
They, among other things, they beheaded 70 Christians, Islamic State did. ISIS in the Congo. And that was just part of it. The decapitation was part of this. Even more people got killed. Right? That's what we're talking about in terms of justice. If Dr. King stands up and he quotes from the Hebrew prophets, let justice roll down like water and righteousness like a mighty stream, what is that supposed to mean? If I'm then going to not only demonize Israel unjustly, unfairly, but ignore all these other atrocities you and I are just talking about here, that's nothing close to justice. That's a mockery of justice. And it carries its own residue, right? That becomes a very, whether a person's religious or they feel that in terms of what the universe, how it repays, what kind of payment comes back to ignoring real injustices while focusing in on and distorting justice, right? The payment on that's going to be huge, right? Because here are people's lives that are being destroyed as we speak, but we don't want to talk about that. We want to talk about Israel being an apartheid state, which is complete buffoonery.
But you keep going back to Dr. King.
Yes, sir.
And I growing up in Israel, it's actually very interesting. I tell people, like, as an Ashkenazi Jew, I became white the moment I moved to the U.S. I was never white because that wasn't my thing. But I understand the moment that I came here, it's not just how you perceive yourself. It's how others perceive you. Yes. If I get stopped over by a police officer. Yes, sir. Yes, sir. And I tell people I stopped being white on October 7th, 2023, when I realized it's not really about skin, it's something else.
Yes, sir.
But I grew up reading about Dr. King and about Malcolm X, and I realized the importance of having the two kind of polar opposites that are working together, but also different views.
Yes, sir. Yes, sir.
You don't see much quotes of Dr. King in the protest right now. You see a lot of Malcolm X. You see a lot of posters of Malcolm X. You see a lot of more of that militant narrative. Not, by the way, just by Black Americans, also non-Black Americans.
Yes, sir. Absolutely.
What's that shift? Why 60 years
and
it's completely different?
To your last point, the goal, I didn't say this in the beginning, and I guess I should interject this here. We're talking about the PLO scheme. It wasn't about the Black community. The Black community was a means to an end. Yasser Arafat didn't reach out to the Jesse Jacksons and the others. You see all these different photo ops. In order to make other Black people feel a certain way about Israel, it was to be a universal sign to other people that Israel was indeed evil. Why? Because I'm standing next to people who represent justice. Right? This is why I say often, the main campuses that are on fire aren't the HBCUs, it's the predominantly white campuses. Proof positive right there. With all the encampments that were going on, did you have some stuff that was going on some of the HBCUs? To a certain degree, but where did most of the violence happen? More than like 90% of the population is white or Asian, possibly, right? And my point being, I'm making a ratio, I'm saying the goal was to sell it as a justice movement. Again, out of context, he was very anti-Zionist, right? Said a lot of anti-Semitic stuff. But like I said about the Eldridge Cleaver thing, I'm chuckling because it's just cynical. Malcolm X said lots of stuff, including the things that got him killed. What got him killed was not what he said about Zionism or Jews. What got him killed is what he said about the nation of Islam. What got him killed is what he talked about how Elijah Muhammad had these other things going on that had nothing to do with building the black nation, right? What got him killed was after he made Hajj and came back and he saw Muslims, he said, were black, were white, were Asian, were Hispanic. He recognized that he had been sold a bill of goods. When he started speaking out that way, that's what got him killed. And my point, what would have happened? You know, he was killed at 39, just like Dr. King. Neither one even saw 40 years old. What would he have done with Zionism at some point? What would he have done at some of those other things? Because he already began to retract. He even said to the press, up to this point, you've heard everything I say be in the context of the Honorable Elijah Muhammad said, the Honorable Elijah Muhammad said, I'm no longer saying that. I will now speak my own words. That's what got him killed. So when he began to speak differently, what he thought about Zionism and Jews came from Elijah Muhammad and the Nation of Islam. He broke away from that group and began to speak. He began to speak differently with white people. He said, before, I would say white people have nothing to do with what we're doing. Now we can work together. It's just that we got to make sure we maintain. He started speaking differently. He started talking about what was going on in the education. He said that here in the Harlem area, we want to be in control of our own school district. Why? He's talking about having agency. He began to speak differently than what was actually going on from where he came from. It's got him killed. So my point is that the people are quoting Malcolm X, they'll quote Eldridge Cleaver because he had some nasty stuff to say until his quote unquote conversion. They don't talk about that part because either they don't know or they're trying to hide it. I tell young people when I have those types of things, you said, always find out the whole story. Learn the whole story, right? Don't just get the boilerplate and everything, wear the Che Guevara t-shirt. Yeah. Find out who the people were and then go deeper, right? Because you'll find people have a journey. David, what you thought 20, 30 years ago may not be what you think right now, and so on and so forth.
And I hope I change my mind in 20 years.
We're supposed to. We're supposed to evolve. Not our values, right, but we're supposed to evolve. We're supposed to learn. We're supposed to mature, right? So when I think about the fact that Dr. King and Malcolm X were killed at 39, who knows what else would they may have come to? What else would they have changed their core values? Probably not. But he definitely, as a Malcolm X, he definitely began to change his approach to things. He began to change some of his verbiage where things were concerned. And now, for people watching this podcast, and Dumi Sani is saying that Malcolm X was a Zionist. Nope, never said that. What I'm saying is that the things that got him killed weren't about what he said about Zion. The things that got him killed is what he said about the organization that he came from, because he began to think differently. He said himself, I began to think for myself. I was told things, but I started thinking differently. That's how we challenge young people. Find out.
Okay, I have so many questions, so I want to just one more of it and then move on. But
yes,
someone might say, okay, so let's not get too up in arms about what's happening in colleges. Give them 20 years, they'll grow up, they'll turn 40, they'll have a mortgage, they'll have kids, everything's going to be fine. Mm. No.
Was that a question?
What would be your reaction to something like that?
So the college campus issue, which for me, for years now, that has been a very specific thing where the whole Israel, America, one of the professors said a few years ago, a past professor from DePaul University, Jason Hill, called the campuses national security threats. The level of violence, Jew hatred, Israel hatred, America hatred, right? Because they'll burn American flags, Israeli flags, right? And that's what's going on. The destruction of Western civilization. I feel that two things. Number one, the campuses are going to get worse before they get better. This is my feeling, regardless of what administration's in power. I say it for a reason, number one. Number two, because the root of the problem is not really actually being addressed. We know that the young man, Mahmoud Khalil, will be deported. I think you and I probably feel the same way in that. That's a good thing, although it's unfortunate what all is happening. Not unfortunate, he is part of a much broader issue and what I call pawns on the chessboard.
Exactly. I've been telling my wife,
yes,
and everyone's been kind of like pushing back and say, don't be a bleeding heart liberal. I was like, no, listen, we didn't have to be this way. This guy came susceptible to radicalization, but he has been radicalized. Yes. He should pay the price
Yes.
because this is adulthood.
Yes.
But it didn't have to get to this point.
So one of the things we came to the realization of before, again, specifically the campus issue, it has been on fire for a long time, decades. This is nothing new. October the 7th took it to a completely different level, right? But it's been bad for a very, very long time. Go back to 2014, for example. There are several student professors from San Francisco State University who literally, on California taxpayer dollars, flew to Israel, went to Ramallah, and met with members of the PFLP. This is a designated terrorist organization. Came back, and that's when they started platforming Leila Khaled and some of these other terrorists. And these, come on, Dave Chai, that's against the law. If they're a terrorist organization, how are you, a professor, going to take tax dollars to fly to meet with terrorists and then come back? What in the world's going on? But nothing happened to those professors. This has been going on for a long time. So by the time you're dealing with the students, again, pawns on the chessboard, the billions of dollars coming from Qatar that are funding the administrations, that are funding the departments, that's where the real big fish is. But it doesn't really get talked about. Remember 2 years ago, December 23, they had those three professors over there of the Ivy League schools who were testifying on Capitol Hill? And we told people then, this is a dog and pony show. They got upset with us. Oh, do we sign? Aren't you guys concerned? This is a good thing. I was like, going, I'm not saying it's not a good thing. We need to talk about it. But said, they're not going to do anything. They've known about this for a long time. And then 2 years later, what's happened? Nothing. Nothing. They replaced those people with other people. And has it gotten any better at Harvard? No. Right? So why? Because the core issue hasn't been dealt with. And the core issue is money. There's a lot of corruption that's actually there in place. Because if you're talking about billions of dollars coming into these departments, Saeb Erekat, the chief propagandist for Yasser Arafat, he was offered a position at Harvard after he retired from being the PLO spokesperson. I'm sitting there watching that. People are congratulating him, both pro-Israel and anti-Israel. Oh, yeah, what a great statesman. I'm going, what? Did I miss something? Did somebody, help me, right? This guy was helping sell all these genocidal things. Yasser Arafat was the muscle. This dude was standing in front of the cameras and lie about all the stuff that Israel was doing while the PLO was slaughtering Israelis. I'm going, so why is it a good thing that he's at the Kennedy School of blah, blah, blah at Harvard? I'm watching the game. I said, wow. So when October the 7th happens, oh, let me back up. May 21, David Shai. Can I call you David?
David, but everyone calls me. It's a story. Yes. And by the way, I notice a lot of Christians call me David. Because it's like...
Yeah, because it's a very Christian name. Yeah, like King David. Okay, I'm sorry. You guys can answer
You can
that,
call me whatever you want.
So May 21, we track this. Our organization tracked this, Institute for Black Solidarity with Israel. We were tracking the college things and everything, right? May 21 was when Islamic Jihad fired 4,000 rockets into Israel, if you remember that. About 1,200 of those rockets hit actually Palestinian territories. Arab Palestinians in Gaza were being killed by the rockets. Media didn't care. Right? While that's happening, Israel's defending itself. Jews were being beat up in the streets then. I know Jewish friends in L.A., their cafes being chased down the street in New York. This is before you get to October 7, 2023. When that happened, we had a staff meeting. And we said, we've crossed the Rubicon. The next flash between Gaza and Israel, we're going to have basically what we're having now. We didn't predict October the 7th. We weren't saying that at all. We were saying, but the next clash. I said, because the West and the United States have been so captured with this Islamist thing, this called the Red-Green Alliance, very, very far left, communist type of let's destroy America, coming together with this very Islamist, let's destroy America from this perspective. Same thing happens in the United Nations. You got Russia, you have the Arab states coming together to vote against Israel and the United States, right? That we're really concerned with what we're seeing. Fast forward to October 23, lo and behold, not just the encampments, but the violence and the all of that, right? Our concern was that for a long time, the college issue has never really been taken seriously. And number one issue, we believe, is because of the money. There's too much money. There's a lot of, you know, mouth talking about, right? I say, okay, but unless we're going to do things like designate Qatar, which is the seat of the Muslim Brotherhood, right? Unless we're going to designate the Muslim Brotherhood a terrorist organization, unless we're going to make it, and much of the money, you probably know this, when it comes from these different states, they're actually coming, it's unreported. The schools are supposed to tell the government how much money is supposed to be open source, if you will. Much of that money is not being reported. Not to mention the fact that we have an Arab base in Doha in Qatar, so billions of our dollars go to that as well. So all the other Arab countries that we are friends with, we can't have a base there. So I'm looking at those types of things, right? And some people might think I'm oversimplifying everything, but I just don't. I think if it walks like a duck, practices. So I'm watching all this stuff. So when we come against an SJP student or Mahmoud Khalil, which again, I'm all for, I get that. I also get that that becomes a distraction, because if that's all we're going to do, all do we sign, we should be deporting. I say, first of all, how are you going to deport American-born students who hate America and Israel? What are you going to do with them? Born in Topeka, Kansas. Where are they going to go? Right? So that's the first thing. You're dealing with foreign-born students. But what about the students who are also there burning American flags and coming against the Jewish people that are born and raised here? You don't even have a plan for that. How are you going to stop this indoctrination? And what does it look like when we're still friends with Qatar? Or when Turkey, who's also a bad actor, is part of NATO? What kind of message are we sending as Western leaders that we stand against this ideology, but we work with the people who are producing the ideology? The billions of dollars that go to Hamas through UNRWA and all these other organizations, we are funding global jihad, but we say we are against it. As a pastor, I look at that kind of duality and I say, well, you know what? God doesn't really play that game. Either I believe that as a pastor, I'm saying as a Christian pastor, either I believe there's a blessing for people who pray for the peace of Jerusalem, bless those who bless, curse those who curse you, or I don't. I don't get to fund Hamas and then wave an Israeli and American flag about how much I stand with Israel. That's BS. Do one or the other. And that's where I believe we are as a nation now. We fund. I used to say that Iran was the number one state sponsor of terrorism. We are. We still send $40 million a week to the Taliban. Still. This is still happening right now. We are funding the jihad. Right. So we are, our State Department was implicated in funding Boko Haram in Nigeria. How in the world are we fighting against an ideology that we are funding with our taxpayer dollars? And oh, by the way, we stand with Israel and the Jewish people. No, you don't. That's why I think part of the moral and spiritual crisis that we're in right now in our nation.
I think a very apt metaphor is the war on drugs, right?
Yes.
The big war on drugs, who ended up paying the price? Users,
yes.
Small-time dealers,
yes,
and
sir.
Maybe some local dealers.
Yes.
They didn't go after the cartels. They didn't go after so who's going to pay the price now? Some students who has been brainwashed to wear a keffiyeh and mm-hmm. scream some things.
Yep.
Some local leaders like Mahmoud Khalil.
Yes, sir. Yes.
But the drugs are still, you're going to deport one guy, another
yes.
guy's going to come in.
Absolutely.
You got to go and deal with the problem,
absolutely.
Not with,
yes.
Yeah.
And to me, Shai, this is part of it when we're talking about the fighting for justice, because what we're outlining now is if we're over the target and you're talking about the amount of money and possible corruption and everything, not trying to be conspiracy theorists, but we're talking about what the actual root of the problem is, now you're more dangerous territory. Because if you want to just kind of talk about the Muslim Student Association, the Institute for Justice in Palestine, which is fine, right? And they're causing all kinds of havoc, but not about where the money's coming from, what their ties are to, both directly and indirectly, terrorist organizations. Like I told you about those professors who go meet with the PFLP. Because now we're talking about the root of it, and now you're in a little bit more trouble. And one of my favorite books in the Old Testament, this is in this work that I do, is the book of Nehemiah. Nehemiah is fascinating to me.
Just let me say this for
yes,
for
sir.
Jewish listeners or Israeli listeners. Nehemiah in Hebrew would be Nehemiah.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes, thank you, sir. As a little kid, it's funny, when I grew up in church, I would read my Bible, but I read the Old Testament more than the New Testament. I didn't know the difference as a kid, right? And so these stories are always fascinating, from the patriarchs to David to these types of stories here. And the Nehemiah, what was interesting is that it's 13 chapters long, but by the first 4.5 chapters, the initial work is done. Why did he come back from Persia? To oversee the rebuilding of the wall. It was the national security for Judah, for Jerusalem. But the rest of the time he spends dealing with government corruption.
Today's conversation with Dumisani Washington, the CEO of the Institute for Black Solidarity with Israel, is going to be part of a two-part discussion. Dumisani and I sat for almost 2 hours, and I just was so enthralled by everything he had to say that I decided to keep the cameras and the recording going and just deep dive into the conversation. So I hope you enjoy the first part. The second part will be coming out next week. Here I am with Dumisani Washington.